your story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Back in October 17, 1961, French police killed hundreds of Algerian protesters and dozens were thrown into the River Seine. This made it one of the darkest pages of France's checkered colonial history. Today, called by France's Human Rights League, people took to the streets of the capital, Paris, to mark the deadly crackdown. So tonight, we're putting the spotlight on the massacre that was covered up, and the significance of the rally that was held today.
President Emmanuel Macron has become the first French head of state to attend the commemoration of the bloodiest day in Paris since the French Revolution. 60 years ago, French police massacred over 300 Algerians who were demonstrating during the Algerian War for Independence. Police opened fire on unarmed, peaceful protesters with bodies tossed in the Seine River. The state-sponsored rampage included 12,000 arrests, with innocent detainees tortured for days at a nearby stadium. However, Macron did not issue a formal apology, angering many. He did admit the massacre was, quote, inexcusable.
It's not 10 years after, or even 20 years after the murders. It's 60 years after. That's a very important fact, which shows there is a lot of hypocrisy flying around. It's no wonder that the Franco-Algerian community is not very impressed.
We must remember that there were many other massacres before this one. Macron is trying to portray this one as some simple beatings by the Nazi collaborating Paris police chief instead of the state crime which it was.
At the time, the massacre was covered up by the mainstream media, and Paris did not acknowledge the murders until 2012. In 2017, Macron formally acknowledged the obvious, that France had used systematic torture in Algeria. However, he did not open up the archives on the infamous OAS, the Secret Army Organization, a state-sponsored terrorist group dedicated to crushing Algerian independence.
Le massacre d'État.
We didn't learn about this state massacre in our history classes in school. I only learned about it from a book called The Battle of Paris. It was when this book came out in 1991 that France finally started to have any discussion about what happened to these peaceful Algerian protesters.
The massacre failed to prolong more than 130 years of domineering French colonization of Algeria. A year later, France would finally accept peace and independence, following the death of an estimated 1.5 million Algerians. The victory would inspire independence movements and progressive politics around the Muslim world, including in Iran. By waiting so long to admit the atrocities of 1961, France has allowed many killers to escape justice. The families of the victims say they won't stop fighting for transparency, honesty, and respect for the countless victims of French colonization. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
To discuss that further, we're joined by Ian Williams, a senior analyst from the Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us live from New York, and Joe Quinn, senior editor of SOT.net, joining us from Paris. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So let's begin with Mr. Quinn from Paris. Now, this peaceful march was called in protest at a nighttime curfew, and we still don't know what the exact instructions were given to security forces back then. But can you tell us how this all came to light?
How the details of the massacre came to light?
How did this massacre come to light? What events led to France talking about it? Because we know that at that time it was covered up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was covered up, as your correspondent has said, and nothing was revealed about it until 2012, when I suppose different pressure groups, the pressure from different groups was brought to bear in order to reveal what actually happened. I mean, it was obviously quite a lot of people knew, but it wasn't publicly known. It was covered up at the time. But yeah, almost at the time, 2012, 50 years later, it was you would think it was time to admit it. But obviously, it's something that is very sensitive for the state, and it's sensitive for any state to admit to those kind of atrocities, because France is a democracy, a fully fledged democracy, and the origin of democracy, I would say, and for this kind of a history, relatively recent history, to be revealed is very very painful for the state and for a lot of people, and they don't want it to be revealed. But it's very similar. Many other countries around the world, particularly like the US and the UK, have similar histories that they've covered up, and can in some cases continue to cover up to this day, of those similar kinds of massacres or killings, state-sponsored killings of civilians. So, but yes, it is quite an egregious one in 1961, and I think it's good that it has come to light. It came to light almost 10 years ago, and that is being discussed to this day.
Since you mentioned that France is considered, from what I understand, from what you said, the cradle of democracy, don't you think that this should have come to light a lot sooner, at least many, a couple of years maybe after this happened, not decades after?
That would happen, but like I said, that's not the way Western democracies work. And many Western democracies have engaged in these kind of state-sponsored killings of significant or large numbers of people at certain times over the past, 70, 80 years, let's say since the Second World War. Several states, modern Western democracies, have engaged in those kind of killings, and it's simply not something that they are interested or willing or happy to have revealed. I can say, for example, you could consider the various atrocities in carried out by the British government in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in Northern Ireland that were from the 1970s onwards, and there's many details of those that are still not been revealed, because it obviously casts a Western democracy in a very poor light. I mean, it presents them more like a kind of third world dictatorship, So it conflicts with their self-image, and it conflicts with the image that the people in those Western democracies have of themselves and of their government, and it threatens to undermine trust in the government among the population. So for many very obvious reasons, governments who engage in these kinds of state-sponsored murder do not want them to be revealed. And if they can get away with not revealing them, they will. They will not reveal them ever. And certainly there's probably quite a lot of state secrets about what Western democracies have done over the past 70 years that have not yet and will not ever be revealed about what they have done.
Well, Mr. Quinn, it seems to me that you are condoning in some way this cover-up. Anyhow, we're not discussing the difference between democracy or totalitarian regimes. So let's move on to the next question, because I think this discussion is actually derailing from what we want it to be. When it comes to the Paris massacre, well, as you mentioned yourself, the government has done very little. In 2012, François Hollande recognized that it had happened, and that was the first time a French president had done so. And President Macron, this time, said that these crimes that were committed under the authority of the police chief was, quote-unquote, inexcusable. Mm-hmm. But this means that both of these presidents have fallen short of an official apology, which is basically, I think, the first thing that anyone would demand. Why do you think is it so?
It's politics, basically. In each of those cases, Francois Hollande and now Macron have an eye on their potential re-election. In the case of Macron, it's next April when he is up for potential re-election. And as much as, you know, there's a sizable percentage of Algerian descendants, let's say, or Algerians in France, up to maybe 5 million, but that's still a very small percentage of the French population. And he, you know, him and his advisors are weighing up, you know, what way he should approach this and how much he should apologize and how much he should not apologize in the context of him garnering as many votes as possible in next April's election. And that's pretty much the long and the short of it. That's why he hasn't done what he should have done, which is to openly admit exactly what the French state sanctioned in 1961 and indeed during the Algerian War of Independence, the many other hundreds of thousands of people that were killed as a result of that war. But, you know, it's French colonialism and it's wrong and it should be denounced and it should be presented in that way by any responsible government. But, of course, that's not... We don't live in that ideal world, and governments always have an eye on presidents and politicians have an eye on their re-election, and they're always tailoring their comments and their public statements with a view to how it's going to impact the population or what the population are going to think about it and whether or not it would be good for the re-election or bad for the re-election. It's very cynical, but that's the way it is.
Thank you very much. Let's bring in Ian Williams. Mr. Williams, by your expression on your face, I'm guessing that you don't totally agree with Mr. Quinn. So I'm going to ask you this next question. Why do you think no one has been tried and even preliminary official inquiries into the events were all dismissed, a total of 60 claims?
Well, as we're basking in the glory of Western democracy, I always remember what Gandhi said when he was when he arrived in London. He was asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he said he thought it would be a good idea. And democracy has never been quite what it was, and you have to remember the particular circumstances. France, I wouldn't accept its claims to be the cradle of democracy. It's also the cradle of the guillotine, of the military coup, of nationalism in its present essence, where the state is more important than everything else. So it has many, many sins, and a lot of them come from the colonial era. Everyone accepts, you know, without, because they're not a Western democracy, so-called, that power in Algeria resides in a cabal of businessmen and politicians and generals. And, you know, that's almost taken as axiomatic, and the elections are just occasional attempts to legitimize that. And sadly, the same is very true of the so-called Western democracies, particularly in France, where the deep state, you have to remember the circumstances in 1961, is behind the scenes. Charles de Gaulle, then president, was negotiating towards a settlement with the Algerians, but he got to power based upon the full support of the people who wanted to keep Algeria French. So he had this internal military cabal that was running things. They were running the police. They were often, you know, friendly former Nazis, as the police chief at the time was, and they were all looking after each other. So, you know, these power centers within there, the deep state, as we call them, they had no interest at all in broadcasting this. And, you know, their attachment to democracy was simply superficial. It was a label they could put on their own activities. This was the era when even the French Socialist Party and even the French Communist Party was not as, was often more in favor of French civilization than it was of anti-imperialism, and thought that the way forward was for the Algerian workers to join with the French workers. It was a very complex situation, and in that complexity, people get away with things. But especially when you have a deep state, a police force, and an army that don't want the boat rocked. And even afterwards, we have to remember, de Gaulle's victory was somewhat precarious. He needed these people to stay in. He had to persuade them that he effected a necessary compromise to maintain things. And he went on. I mean, eventually he came out with the Fifth Republic, which is closest thing to an elected dictatorship in Western Europe. Basically, he stayed in power regardless. and they will. It's in that complex way of looking. Just have to look at America. I mean, how many years has it taken for the My Lai massacre? It's there. Everyone knows about it. The warrants officer who actually, remember, in Vietnam, he landed a helicopter and pointed the guns at American troops to stop them massacring Vietnamese civilians. Not many Americans know that at all. That's not in the headlines. To give him his due, Clinton actually gave him a medal. But that was another 30 or 40 years after the event. So there's a lot of this. The British have eventually got round for a half-hearted apology for the Amritsar massacre in 1919. Completely unjustified. It caused a row at the time. But there are a lot of people in the colonial office and in the army that wanted to make sure it never got any, that it never got too much publicity. They didn't make the history books. So you have this Orwellian view of where the inner state controls what people see and hear and what the popular image is. So, you know, obviously the 1961 massacre is very embarrassing because they weren't even protesting for Algerian independence. They were protesting for the rights as French citizens, as they claimed to be at the time, to go out after 8 o'clock, the right not to be discriminated against and arrested because they were Arabs, because they were Algerians. And it's this which gave the mockery to the whole idea of Western democracy. And one of the reasons, it doesn't fit the self-image. So of course it's going to be suppressed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams, for that very elaborate explanation. And the background information that you gave us about Charles de Gaulle, that was also interesting. So, Mr. Quinn, I saw that you agreed with some parts of what Mr. Williams was saying. Can you please draw the line between what happened in 1961, especially considering what Mr. Williams pointed to, and French colonialism, basically, and what happened in Africa, and particularly in Algeria?
Well, it was part of the ongoing war of independence in Algeria when Algerians were essentially fighting against the French for independence, and of course when that happens and you have a sizable population of Algerians in France, the state is immediately going to see those as potential enemy combatants, and they're going to clamp down on them. They're going to, as your other guest mentioned, they were under curfew, they were viewed with extreme suspicion, and when they responded and reacted against that, they were massacred on this day in 1961, but that was just a continuation of many, many massacres that had happened in Algeria by French troops against Algerians in the war for independence before that. So in that sense, it was, you know, the war had suddenly come. The war that was ongoing in Algeria for independence had suddenly come to Paris, on the streets of Paris that day.
So do you believe? Do you believe that racism played a role here? Because at that time, apparently, these people were also called pieds noirs, which means people with black feet.
Well, the pieds noirs comment was actually the French colonists in Algeria, because they wore black leather shoes. They're the only ones in Algeria who wore black leather shoes. So pieds noirs refers to actually French colonists in Algeria. But certainly, racism, for sure. I mean, this is, you're just talking about the other, you're talking about the enemy, you know. I mean, in times of war, you could almost say that, racism comes to the fore for sure, but, war dehumanizes the other all the time. Even among people of the same race, the same skin color, atrocities have been carried out by British soldiers against other white people. You can call it racism, and certainly it was that, but it's more about what goes on in war and in the minds of people who engage in war, where the people that are fighting against become less than human. I think dehumanization is probably worse than racism, because once you dehumanize someone else, you'll do a lot worse to them than you will if you just don't like their race, let's say. So it's worse than racism.
Mr. Williams, I believe you had something to say about this question.
Well, as I was saying, the pieds noirs were the French colonists who were a huge lobby in France. There are several million who basically left. They were driven out, essentially, on independence, and they moved back to France, and they brought all of their colonial attitudes with them. They both a thirst for revenge. They reinforced the existing racism. And we have to show just how much racism was involved here, how much the anti-Arabism Islamophobia, because you remember that this has international repercussions. Because of the war in Algeria, the French persuaded the British and Israelis to attack Suez and almost precipitated World War III. This was a rearguard action to defend French Algeria. Later on, they went even further, and as a backup to the Israelis, they provided the nuclear weapons that Israel now has. They provided the they provided the Dimona reactor that Israel has, all tied in to their complete antipathy to an independent Arab Algeria. And you know, I've got to say that the Algerian revolutionaries were not exactly saints by any means, and they did not cover themselves with glory always. And they played into the French. If you ever saw the movie The Battle for Algiers, it shows the classic terrorist tactics of blowing up people and things to provoke an overreaction from the state. And the point about the French state was it could be guaranteed to overreact, and it did. I mean, it was the French reactions which guaranteed an Algerian majority for independence and antipathy to France. The fact that they were indiscriminately massacring and imprisoning and torturing people. And that's classic terrorism. You provoke the authorities into doing things that they shouldn't do and deprive them the opportunity to do hearts and minds because you made them treat everybody as an enemy. And that's still, you know, there's still a huge amount of suspicion in France, I believe. From my experience, there is a lot of anti-noir, anti-black racism, but the anti-Arab is a real recurrent thread in there. And that's all part of these influences that come back from this era that no one's ever forgiven. And the French establishment has not really made any attempt to combat it because the French establishment is a product of this era. The French establishment is a product of these people, these massacres and these torturings. You know, the police chief, any police chief now, he mightn't have taken part in it, but his superiors probably did when he was a kid, when he was starting out. And that tradition continues right the way through.
Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. Now, we've heard from French citizens of Algerian descent saying that in France, they live as if they don't exist. Do you think that France will ever stop treating these people as second-class citizens, according to what they say?
It's a difficult question to answer because, obviously, it's I don't know if it's representative of the opinion of all Algerians in France. As I said, there's about 5 million of them, but it's a legacy of colonialism, essentially. And I mean, when you as a French state did invade another country and spend 130 years there, you create very strong ties, and obviously there's a transfer of people back and forward, and suddenly you have people from the state that you've colonized living in the colonizer's territory, and setting themselves up there. And I mean, it's difficult for people when you have a sizable percentage of them to fully integrate to a different culture and a different religion in particular. And it's not surprising that they have, to one extent or another, separated themselves off from mainstream French culture and become a people within a people in a certain sense. I don't think there's in France an official attitude from the state to treat those people as second-class citizens. It's a bit more complicated than that, and the Algerian descendants, or descendants of Algerians in France today, do see themselves as more Algerian than French, and I think they have every right to do that, although it doesn't. It makes the situation quite complicated.
Thank you very much, Mr. Joe Quinn, senior editor from SOT.net, joining us from Paris. Thank you very much, sir, for sharing your views. And also Mr. Ian Williams, senior analyst from the Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us from New York. Thanks to you also for following this edition of The Spotlight.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. For such is the state of the disbelievers, until when death comes to one of them, he says, "My Lord, send me back." That I might do righteousness in that which I left behind. No, it is only a word he is saying, and behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
As you have been with us previously, we started talking about these two verses, حَتَّى إِذَا جَاءَ أَحَدَهُمُ الْمَوْتُ قَالَ رَبِّ ارْجِعُونَ, until when death comes unto one of them, and he says, "My Lord, send me back again." لَعَلِّي أَعْمَلُ صَالِحًا فِيمَا تَرَكْتُ, that I might do righteousness in that which I have left behind. كَلَّا إِنَّهَا كَلِمَةٌ هُوَ قَائِلُهَا, nay, but it is a mere word that he says. وَمِنْ وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ, and behind them is a partition until when they shall be raised up. The question to be answered is barzakh. The word barzakh in this verse, or the partition as we translated it, or the intermediate world. What kind of world is it? And where is it exactly? The most important point is that how we can prove that such a world actually exists between this world and hereafter, that all people will go to before moving on to hereafter. And what is the state and situation of the believers and righteous people in this intermediate world? These are the kind of questions which exist in this field, and there are some hints to these questions in the verses of the Holy Quran and of course the Islamic traditions, and I assume it is necessary to answer them as much as possible. First, let's talk about the word itself. The Arabic word barzakh originally means that which stands between the two things. Later, whatever stood between any two affairs came to be called barzakh. As a consequence, The world that exists between this world and hereafter is called the Barzakh, and is also sometimes called the world of the grave, or the world of spirits. The reason for the existence of this world is based upon the traditional proofs, and there are numerous Quranic verses that explicitly or implicitly are referring to the Barzakh. This verse, and behind them is a partition until the day when they are raised up, وَمِن وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ, is apparently indicating the existence of such a world. Some scholars say that the word Barzakh is a barrier that prevents the human beings from returning to this world after they die, actually. But the phrase, until the day they are raised up, is indicating that this barrier is between this world and the Day of Judgment, and this barrier is not between human beings and the world. This is one important aspect to be noted.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Among the verses that explicitly show the existence of such a world are those that speak about the life of the martyrs. The Holy Quran says, وَلَا تَقُولُوا لِمَنْ يُقْتَلُ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتِ, and do not say of those who are slain in the way of Allah as dead. بَلْ أَحْيَاء, nay, they are alive. The Prophet ﷺ is addressed in this verse, but all the believers are addressed in the 154th verse of chapter Baqarah, which announces that, and call not those who are slain in the way of Allah as dead, nay, they are living, only you perceive not. The intermediate world not only exists for high-ranking believers such as the martyrs, but it also exists for the disobedient unbelievers such as the Pharaoh and his associates. The concept of Barzakh is explicitly mentioned in verses of the Holy Quran. For example, in chapter Ghafir, the 46th verse, we read, النَّارُ يُعْرَضُونَ عَلَيْهَا غُدُوًّا وَعَشِيَّ, in front of the fire, they will be brought every morning and evening. وَيَوْمَ تَقُومُ السَّاعَةُ أَدْخِلُوا آلَ فِرْعَوْنَ أَشَدَّ الْعَذَابِ, and on the day when the hour is established, it will be said, cast the people of Pharaoh into the most awful chastisement. There are also other verses talking about this subject, but they are not as explicit and clear as these couple of verses that we discussed. We will, inshallah, talk about other aspects of this barzakh and partition in this verse in the next programs. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند این ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, through his historic speeches and messages, stressed that occurrence of divine revelation to the Honorable Prophet of Islam and his mission resulted in awareness and awakening of the entire humanity. Imam Khomeini stated that the divine mission of the Holy Prophet has caused broad great awareness and blessings for the entire mankind. Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, frequently invited believers and faithful people to follow footsteps of the Holy Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors to attain prosperity in this world and salvation hereafter. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, he has PhD on Islamic science.
As we know that Imam Khomeini is the founder of the Week of Unity, and this was a big step that he took in order to make Muslims united, because the way the oppressors or the enemies of Islam are planning against Islam, therefore it is the duty of jurists, scholars, the esteemed personalities to think about the unification of the Muslim Ummah. And they must unite it against the oppressors. Therefore, I have a part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, where Imam Khomeini is clearly talking to the Muslim Ummah, and he says that the Muslims must be a united hand against all the oppressors. Now, when we look at the Quran, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he was creating Adam alayhi salam, he said to the angels and all the creatures of that time that inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa, that I'm sending my caliphate or representative on the earth. Now, the first objection that was made by the angels after what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, they said that, are you going to send someone who shed blood and who does corruption? أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَنْ يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا. Are you sending someone to the earth, مَنْ يُفْسِدُ, who does corruption on the earth? وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءَ, and he sheds blood.
يَا رَبَّنَا صَلِّ عَلَى طَاهَ النَّبِي وَآلِهِ
صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ.
today we can see that the way the oppressors, the Taghut rebels, they are shedding bloods of innocent people in Yemen, in Palestine, in Kashmir, in different parts of the world, in Afghanistan. We can see all this, who made basically ISIS and Daesh and different terrorist groups, they injected them in the Islamic world. Therefore, we can see that Imam, many years before, he has said that the Muslims must be a united hand against all the oppressors. Why? Because these oppressors are planning against Islam, and it is the duty of Muslims to be united, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Imam Sadegh's blessed birthday. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Heartiest congratulations to you on a day of double joy. It is obvious the 17th of Rabiul Awwal is the auspicious birth anniversary of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. For your information, this blessed day also happens to be the birth anniversary of the Prophet's 16th fallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, in 83 AH, exactly on the 136th birthday of his illustrious ancestor, the Prophet of Islam. What a blessed coincidence. So let us listen to a special feature that we have prepared in this regard. First, let us first contemplate on a gem of an advice given by the sixth Imam to one of his followers. O son of Jundab, regard him who ruptured relations with you. Give him who deprived you of his bestowals. Treat kindly he who mistreated you. Greet him who reviled you. Be just to him who disputed with you, and pardon him who wronged you in the same way you like others to pardon you. Learn lessons from God's pardoning of you. Do you not see that his son is covering the pious and licentious, and his rain is falling on the virtuous and the wrongdoers? This gem of an advice was given to a person named Abdullah ibn Jundab, and it speaks volumes of the dynamic spirit of Islam. It is the formula for building bridges in society so as to ensure a peaceful and harmonious atmosphere for attracting others to the universal message of Islam. The person who bequeathed these bezels of wisdom to posterity was none other than the reviver of the Prophet's Sunan Sira, that is the behavior and practice, who was born in Medina in the year 83 of the Hijra. It was indeed divine providence that the birthday of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger should also be the birthday, 136 years later, of his 16th fallible heir, who, like the Prophet,
has also earned lasting fame as Sadiq, or the most truthful. Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, needs no introduction. Born in 83 AH, 22 years after the heartrending tragedy of Karbala, where his great-grandfather, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the grandson of the Prophet, was martyred, he spent the first dozen years of his life with his grandfather, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, and another 19 years with his own father, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, whom he succeeded to the Imamat at the age of 31 in 114 AH. He lived in a crucial period of history when the godless Umayyad tyrants were on their way towards the dustbin of history, while the equally ungodly Abbasids were emerging as the new breed of usurpers of the right of political leadership of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. The first 18 years of his imamat saw the tyrannical rule of the Umayyads, Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, Walid II ibn Yazid II, Yazid III ibn Walid II, Ibrahim ibn Walid II, and Marwan II al-Himar, all of whom had no pretension to religiosity and were notorious for their open violation of the laws of God and teaching of the Prophet. In the next 16 years of his imamat, the Prophet's successor shouldered a graver responsibility. First, after the overthrow of the Umayyads, there was the offer of caliphate by one of the victorious generals of the uprising, and the imam, whose authority was God-given, burned the sealed envelope of the offer in the flame of a lamp. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, whose God-given authority as heir of the Prophet's historical proclamation of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, as the divinely designated vicegerent at Qadir in 11 AH, was beyond the grasp of any usurper, desisted from any rash decision when Abu Salama al-Khalal, one of the victorious commanders of the anti-Umayyad uprising, sent him a letter offering the caliphate. The imam coolly burned the sealed letter in the flame of a lamp because he knew that a caliphate which is offered by someone else than God is not the legitimate authority, as was the case with the scandalous gathering of Saqif ibn Sa'ida in Medina, when the deviant group selected a caliph from among themselves after a fist fight amongst themselves, while the Prophet's rightful heir, Imam Ali, was busy in funerary seminary of the Seal of Messengers. One Sunni Iranian chieftain from Khorasan named Sahl ibn Hassan came to Medina and asked Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, as to why he wasn't actively fighting for his denied political rights, in spite of the truth being on his side, when there were thousands of supporters ready to fight with him. The imam asked him to sit down and wait. In the meantime, a servant came and was asked by the imam whether the fire had been kindled. On receiving the reply in the affirmative, the imam took Sahl ibn Hassan with him and went to the oven. The fire was blazing red. The imam turned to Sahl and told him to jump into it. Sahl trembled and begged forgiveness. At this moment, Harun al-Makki, a devoted follower of the Ahlul Bayt, came and was told by the imam to jump into the oven. Harun leapt into blaze without a second thought. The Imam then turned to Sahl ibn Hasan, and as if nothing unusual had happened, started to brief him about the circumstances prevailing in Khorasan, while the eyes and the mind of the Iranian chieftain were occupied with the fate of the person who had jumped into the oven. After a while, the Imam took Sahl toward the oven to show him what had transpired for Harun al-Makki. To his surprise, Sahl saw Harun al-Makki sitting cross-legged, safe and sound in the blazing, all without being scorched or scalded by the fire. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, then asked the Iranian chieftain as to how many of his followers in Khorasan were like Harun al-Makki. Sahl replied, "No one, O master." In the social and jurisprudential fields, it was thus prudence on the part of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, that saved Islam and the Sharia of the Prophet of Islam from suffering the fate of Prophet Jesus' mission that was completely distorted by Paul the Jew to become Christianity as it is known today. In the intellectual fields, so thoroughly did the Imam revolutionize sciences and academic learning that at one time, 4,000 scholars from various parts of the Islamic world, including Asia, Africa, and Europe, sat at the feet of the heir of the Prophet to learn various disciplines, including jurisprudence, theology, rhetoric, ethics, hadith, exegesis of the Noble Quran, accounts of the past prophets, and natural sciences such as physics, chemistry, medicine, astronomy, math, botany, etc. Among its proud products was the father of chemistry, Jaber ibn Hayyan, known as Jaber to medieval Europe. Next was the devilish plot of Mansur Davaniri, the second self-styled caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime. Originally a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, he had memorized thousands of hadith on the merits of Imam Ali, peace upon him, but became a turncoat on assuming rule of the Islamic realm. He not only tormented Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, whose God-given authority he had acknowledged in his days as a persecuted fugitive during Umayyad rule, but labeled the Shia, or devoted followers of the Ahlul Bayt, as Rafizun, or rejectors of the Caliphate. It was a seditious act, since no such sect had ever existed before in Islamic history. In the face of such intricate plots, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, during his 34-year mission as the righteous heir of the Prophet of Islam, bequeathed the seekers of truth the jurisprudence known as Fiqhul Ja'fari. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, possessed the keys of divine knowledge that was beyond the imagination of the pseudo-scholars of his time, including certain self-styled jurisprudents who resorted to qiyas or analogy in religious matters, despite the warnings of the sixth imam of the Prophet's household that Iblis, the outcast, was the first one to disobey God and indulge in this self-destructive habit. Here, us, one such example of the Imam's knowledge as the heir of the Noble Quran. It is related that once, when he was only 11 years old, he entered a class scholars were discussing the subject of astronomy. The Imam, to the surprise of everyone, said, The earth cannot be flat because of the way the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and day and night change in 24 hours. It cannot be possible. The Imam's own uncle, Zayd ibn Ali, has said, in every age there is someone from us, the Ahlul Bayt, who is the hujjat or argument of the Almighty Allah for the people. The hujjat of this age is Ja'far ibn Muhammad, my brother's son. Everyone who follows him will not go astray, and everyone who disobeys him will not be guided.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, IRIB English radio listeners. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based on quotes from the Holy Quran and narrations from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Today we have Brother Abdullah Al-Musawi here in the studio. He's an Islamic researcher at the Hawza Al-Almiyya of Qom. Brother Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here today. So, we were talking about achieving true happiness with our children. Where did we leave off?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'inu rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajah. So we were talking about talking with our children, getting to understand their feelings, to know what they're going through, yeah, and conveying that feeling back to them, making them think that we know exactly what is going through with them. Yeah. Now, today I want to talk about something also along the lines of respecting the child's feelings and emotions. These days we have a lot of children that they are extremely angry. Angry to the extent that they yell at their parents. They say awful things to their parents like, I hate you, I don't like you. And you can even see